Productions. Recorded live.
And I heard another voice from heaven saying, "Come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities." Fellow Adamites, we're seeing the cracks emerge in Babylon. We're seeing the cracks spread. I don't believe it'll be too long now before we hear Babylon the Great is fallen. And Yahweh willing, we shall all be there to witness it, and all the world shall bear witness to the power of Yahweh. If you've not begun to prepare for the things that are to come, the things that are starting to see happen, then you'd best do so now. Now is the time to make preparations, gather supplies, make plans, and focus your efforts to keep on the straight and narrow path. Be right with the Heavenly Father, and He shall bring you through the plagues that await this doomed nation. Today is March 13, 2011, Sunday, and Bill Fink is here with us for the third installment of the Valkyrie Plot. How are you doing tonight, sir?
Hello. Praise Yahweh.
Absolutely. Praise Yahweh. And basically, just a simplified summary of what we've covered so far. The classical wisdom, or rather conventional wisdom, put out there by the mainstream media, the textbooks, the History Channel, and idiots out there that think they know everything about Hitler, is that Hitler was a blundering moron, or at best a rank amateur, who interfered with the German war effort, didn't trust the generals, hated the generals, thought he was better than the generals, and his plans ruined the war effort, particularly on the Eastern Front. And we've shown that not only is that not true, but indeed, he had reason not to trust the generals. He erroneously placed way too much trust in them, and they basically stabbed him in the back.
Well, right. He had It can be demonstrated that Hitler had, and I think we did demonstrate that, the sounder plan for executing a war against the Soviet Union. He got very little cooperation from his generals, and even when they cooperated with him, they didn't always execute his desires. And basically, the plan that proceeded in the war against the Soviet Union was the plan of the generals, and it failed miserably. And Hitler, not being a tyrant and acceding to the senior military officers whom he trusted had more experience, and very often acceding to them, and he was disappointed by them in the end. That they each had a different plan. They wouldn't even talk to each other on equal terms and cooperate. It was a fiefdom of egos.
Absolutely. And if Stalin told some general, "Take your division this way and cross the river at that bridge," and the general thought, "Oh no, that bridge will be too hard. I'll go to a bridge further downstream," well, that general's going to be in a gulag if he's lucky. Otherwise, he's going to be up against the wall.
Well, right. The things that Hitler's generals did in the Second World War and got away with, because Hitler was not a tyrant, that they would have never thought about doing or trying to get away with on Stalin's side of the war in the Soviet Union. That's absolutely true.
Absolutely.
That they would have been hung at dawn in a moment's time.
Just it's exactly the same with these Jews who claim that the Tsar was a tyrant and a bloodthirsty monster, yet all the Jews who rose against him in 1905 were still alive to come back for a second whack in 1917, 1918. They'd been exiled to Siberia for a few years, and most of them somehow managed to escape.
Absolutely. Well, we saw in the East, and we didn't really get into whether or not there was any treachery in the East. There certainly indeed was much treachery in the West, and that's what we've been covering these last 2 weeks, is that Valkyrie plot against Hitler. What we saw in the East, that Hitler, the original war plan was never executed because it was rejected by the generals. Each of the generals basically tried to fight their own war. There was a lot of infighting among them, and because of the lack of cooperation, the lack of clear objectives, and the lack of planning, because there was a lack of objectives, that they lost the war in the East. There's no doubt in my mind. Now they lost the war in the West, plainly because of treachery. And we shall see that. And what we're going to finish this Valkyrie plot, and then we're going to proceed to an article, a good article written by a gentleman named Dan Michaels, that we won't get to it tonight, but we'll probably get to it next week or the week after. And it's it talks about the Valkyrie plot and the failed putsch of July 20th, 1944, which we're discussing here, but it does it from a different perspective. It's entitled "Treason is the Reason why Germany lost World War II, that there's no doubt that even if Germany eventually lost the war, even if eventually she failed, that she failed in 1944 and 1945 because of treachery.
Absolutely, and I want to point out, too, right now that Erhard Milch of the Luftwaffe, he was born to Anton Milch, a Jewish pharmacist, and Clara Rosenau, so she was probably a Jew, too. He was primarily tasked with overseeing German fighter production, and he frequently changed design requirements so that Germany never produced more than a few thousand planes in a single year.
So much for Hitler wanting to kill all the Jews.
And that
wasn't there a good German blue-eyed blonde boy that could take that job?
Milch was sentenced to life imprisonment, and then he was released in 1954.
Well, that's
short life sentence.
Right. By then, Speedo was a four-star NATO general, right? Well, another of Hitler's generals. There was a lot of treachery during the war, and we're going to see that here. We're going to start. We've been talking about the Valkyrie plot against Hitler. It was the sneaking in of a bomb into the Wolfschanze or the Wolfslayer, which was German headquarters, which was Hitler's headquarters, by a German general, and the aftermath of that, and the failed putsch, which happened, which was supposed to go off successfully, but the bomb failed to kill Hitler. And the putsch, of course, happened in Berlin itself, in the Reichstag.
France, they had units that were ready to arrest Gestapo agents in the big cities. They were going to have army units that were commanded by treacherous generals attack SS units and force them to either surrender or kill them.
Right. I'm sorry. The putsch was executed in the Bendler's block, which was near the Reichstag. It was the military headquarters. Well, this is part three of Operation Valkyrie, the last plot against Hitler. This is by Carolyn Jaeger and Wilhelm Mann. Carolyn Jaeger's website, and she has a lot of other good work on her website, and I would suggest people go check it out. She has a link at the top of her website called My Articles, and she has a lot of revisionist history articles that she's written, and a lot of them are pretty good. And that's Carolyn Jaeger, CarolynYaeger.com. She's written a lot of articles for the Barnes Review. This series that we've been covering is with Wilhelm Mann, who's a German scholar, and they are translations of Hermann Giesler's memoir, Ein anderer Hitler, or Another Hitler. And Hermann Giesler was, because of a personal relationship with Hitler, Hermann Giesler being an architect in the employ of the Reich, he was an insider, basically, into a lot of the information that came out in the aftermath of the Valkyrie plot. And here is the translator's introduction to part three, The Last Circle. They asked for the death sentence, and it cannot be anything else. It is just, I erred and did wrong. It was not right to arrogantly interfere as a little human being with God's doing. Those were the last lines written by General Helmut Steif to his wife immediately after being sentenced to death by the People's Court on the afternoon of August 8th, 1944. And let me say as an aside that Hitler really had nothing to do with these court proceedings. Going to the gallows the same day. As Chief of Operations at Army High Command, or OKH, Steif was in a prime position to help the conspiracy. He had regular access to Hitler. He hid the bombs in his office at the OKH headquarters in Mauerwald, East Prussia, not far from Wolfschanze. Steif's first contact was with Army Group Center Chief Hennig von Treskow. Together, they met with Generals Friedrich Albrecht and Ludwig Beck in Berlin in August 1943. They approached General Guderian and General Kluge, but neither one would commit. In October, Stauffenberg asked Steif, I should be pronouncing his name Stief and not Stife, outright to kill Hitler, and Stief refused. But Stief put the bombs into the uniforms to be displayed to Hitler at Klessheim Castle, as described by Giesler in this chapter, Klessheim Castle. Stief was in charge of the event at Klessheim, and after this failure, it was decided that Stauffenberg was the only one who could complete the job. General Stief was on a plane with Stauffenberg and his aide, Lieutenant Heifden, on her flight to Wolfswehr July 20th. He was arrested that night at OKH headquarters, interrogated by SS investigator Hans Rottenhuber, and held from then on. In this third and last segment of our Valkyrie series from Hermann Giesler, there was a fourth segment, and we will cover that next, you will feel, in their anger and arguments against these men and their methods, the sharp pain and deep sadness felt by Hitler and Giesler in the inestimable damage done to the war effort. Giesler and Bormann review past assassination attempts. The hard and sober Kaltenbrunner reports about the interrogations and confessions of the conspirators continued to come in. I had a backlog of reading, this is Giesler talking. For quite a while in my off hours, I was busy with design sketches, partly as supporting material for new discussions, partly due to the ideas and suggestions Adolf Hitler brought to our nightly talks. Moreover, I needed time in order to absorb and gain some distance from what Rottenhuber and Hogel had told me. Now, let me say that Hitler had a profound interest in architecture, and if one reads Mein Kampf, one will find that Adolf Hitler was an accomplished artist, and he really was an accomplished artist. However, he was turned down for art school. But he wasn't turned down because his art wasn't good enough. Adolf Hitler was turned down for art school because his art was very technically exacting, and for that reason, the people at the art school thought that he should go to an architectural school and become a technical artist rather than simply an artist for pleasure.
They thought he should direct his talents in another venue, basically.
Well, right. So it's natural that Hitler would gravitate towards Hermann Giesler because Hitler went to school for architecture and Giesler was an architect. Of course, life had different plans for Adolf Hitler. To continue with Giesler's, report of these events. One morning as I visited Bormann again, he handed me the reports about the interrogation of Major General Helmut Stief. One could get the impression that instead of working for the tasks that they were supposed to perform, the plotters spent most of their time brooding about setups and ways to kill their supreme commander by means of the least danger for themselves. They must stay alive. And
that just shows their absolute cowardice. Since, as I said before, if they really honestly thought the nation will be destroyed if Hitler's not killed, we have to kill him no matter what, they would have just walked up to him, stabbed him in the chest with a dagger, shot him, and then accepted whatever his bodyguards did to them.
Well, right, but in the aftermath of the explosion, we even saw last week where one general had every opportunity to kill Hitler after Hitler survived the explosion, and he had not only did he have every opportunity to kill Hitler, but he was a major member of the plot, and he should have killed Hitler if he had 1 ounce of backbone, and he failed to do so. And there was no doubt that he was not, once the plot failed, that he would not be a suspect. He would be a chief suspect because he was in charge of communications his name was Felgiebel, was in charge of communications at Wolfenschanz, and the communications were definitely tampered with. And in fact, Felgiebel himself attempted to cut off all communications out of Wolfenschanz after the explosion. And that failed because Goebbels was able to make contact with Hitler.
And I want to point out, too, that Hitler was not so unapproachable that 5 or 10 or 15 generals would have been unable to approach him and say, we disagree with the way you're handling the war. Here's what we think's going on, and here's what we'd like to see done, and here are the changes you can implement. They would have us believe, of course, that Hitler would have just had them all shot, but name one general that Hitler had shot because the general criticized him.
Well, after the bombing off, Feldgebel had a conversation with Hitler face-to-face, had his pistol on him, asked about his well-being, congratulated him for surviving the explosion. It shows you what sort of coward he was, that he didn't finish the job right there. He was a coward, and he ended up being executed for his role in this, but he was a coward. And that I think, portrayed all of the Valkyrie participants. They were all cowards.
I'm sure they all knew, too, that killing Hitler would have destroyed the German war effort and thoroughly and totally demoralized the nation and most of the soldiers. That's what they were aiming for, though. They weren't trying to save Germany.
According to Steve, they betrayed Germany. According to Steve, Stauffenberg, at least for a while, thought to let his adjutant, Lieutenant Werner von Haeften, attempt to shoot the Führer. That would be possible at the Führerlager, which is the map room meetings, right? Or at a weapons demonstration. Then, however, they thought that might not be secure enough. After much hesitation, Steve himself, so he said, wanted to take over the assassination on the occasion of a weapons demonstration at the Klesheim Castle near Salzburg, built by Fischer von Erlach. I had participated in redesigning it into a guest house of the Reich. After the heavy weapons demonstration, the Führer was to be shown the new assault uniform for the attack units, backpack, assault rifle, hand grenades. Three sergeants and non-commissioned officers, highly decorated with the gold ranger bar, were selected. Major General Stief intended to have the backpacks loaded with English explosives and a time igniter to be sure to keep himself at a proper distance from the explosion. But because of a time lapse and a predetermined appointment, the Führer canceled the presentation of the new assault equipment after the weapons demonstration, and we returned to the Berghof. During the demonstration, a little general kept my attention. Nervously busy, he stood out amongst the rest of the military staff. Who is that little one here? I asked the SS adjutant. That is Major General Stief. I recalled the particular moment as I continued to read the Rottenhuber report. Quote, true horror among the population, especially amidst the soldiers and low-ranked leaders, caused by the fact that the traitors planned to lay the bomb into the knapsacks of three proven soldiers who would demonstrate the new uniforms for the Führer. I looked at Bormann and said, if what Steve admitted is correct, then he is really a special jewel of this conspiracy clique. In other words, he would sacrifice the lives of three innocent and decorated men, right? Do you, Stauffenberg, who carries out the assassination without consideration for his co-conspirator Brandt, whom he blows into the air, as the better one, do you judge Stauffenberg as the better one? For me, the overall picture is very clear. When Stauffenberg landed at Berlin-Rangsdorf and reported the, what he thought was successful, assassination to those waiting at the Bendlerstrasse, didn't he say then, General Stauffenberg speaking here? Look at that. He had promoted himself to a general, thinking he blew up Hitler. By the way,
the field marshal.
Right. By the way, do you remember the report of the ordnance officer about the strange behavior of Stauffenberg at the Berghof on July 11th? The lager held in a large living room at the Berghof was not yet over. Stauffenberg was no longer needed and asked for permission to be absent. It happened not so long ago. We were both chatting in the back of the hall towards the small living room when the orderly appeared and reported. I just looked over the dining room to make sure that everything is ready for lunch, and there in the middle, behind the Führer's chair, stands the colonel with the one arm. I told him, the room is private. May I ask you? He interrupted me. Pardon, I only wanted to have a look at it. Yes, I said to Bormann. I remember that the colonel with the one arm also said to the orderly, very neat here, beautiful, especially with the bay window, before the orderly asked him to leave the dining room. Borman said, "I then questioned the orderly further. I found out that he, Stauffenberg, had a briefcase with him. What do you think was in it? Turnip salad and pudding in order to contribute something for lunch," was my joking remark. Borman grimaced. "Today we know that nobody could have noticed the briefcase under the broad, long table with the low-hanging tablecloth. At that time, you were the honored guest sitting across from the Fuhrer. Sometime you might thank that corporal," meaning the orderly who escorted Stauffenberg out. I replied, "Those repeated assassination tries, which ended in vain, seem to be fateful. I think about the plot at the Burger Brow, and with the bomb on the airplane, they have tried it once before. Now I'm reading about the infamy at Klesheim and the memory of the affair at the Berghof. Then the July 20th day, miraculously, the Fuhrer survives with only light injuries. Are there still more attempts I don't know about?" "That attempt with the slight injury is only one side of the coin," Borman said. "The other one sits much deeper, believe me. To your question, yes, there were more assassination attempts, which only now we are aware of. Talk about it with both of them. I don't have time." For a while, I continued reading the interrogation protocols of Admiral Canaris and his protege, Oster. Very opaque, strangely blurred. Dark and depressing as those reports were, an amusing moment occurred. The copy of a letter to Major General Hans von Oster from his son, Achim, IA at an Army Corps in Upper Silesia. Its content stayed strongly engraved in my mind. It read like, colon, the quote, "The conditions are very pleasant here. The commanding general is a horseman and a grand seigneur of the ancient regime, a real general, not one of those people's soldiers." That would be a reference to Hitler and a lot of his appointees. I would have liked to have a look at that general. Treason centered in the Abwehr and Army Group Center. Translator's commentary. Major General Hans von Oster was an early opponent of what he feared would be inopportune military solutions for the Czechoslovak and Polish questions. He was a religious man, as were Stief and Stauffenberg.
Now, interestingly enough, I have to ask, what religion was Stauffenberg, since what religion does it teach if you have a gripe with somebody, plot to assassinate them, and if you blow up five or six other people in the process, who cares? Collateral damage. That sounds like a very Mossad-type religion.
Well, right. Religious isn't necessarily, it could be used in the manner of superstitious,
mm-hmm.
and certainly not in the manner of Christian, right?
Absolutely. It sounds like he was more a Mason, and Masonry was his religion.
That could very well be. He was a religious man, as were Stephen Stauffenberg, who was forced to resign from the army in 1932 because of an indiscretion involving the wife of another officer. After a job in connection with the Prussian police, he was able to transfer to the Abwehr, the state intelligence agency, the following year, where he met Hans Bernard Gasevius and Arthur Nebe, working in the Gestapo, and became a confidant of Wilhelm Canaris, the chief of the spy agency.
So Hans von Oster is a very religious man, and his Bible must have had a typo when it got to the part about, you know, not coveting your neighbor's wife.
Well, that's pretty evident that he, like I said, religious could just mean superstitious and not necessarily Christian, right?
And
it's amazing how men of low moral characters seem to find each other, because we have Wilhelm Canaris here, the chief of the spy agency, who was a huge traitor to the German cause. By 1935, Oster was allowed to reenlist in the army, but never on the general staff. When Canaris reorganized the Abwehr in 1938, he made Oster head of the Central Division, Zentralant, in charge of personnel and finances. Personnel problems, right? As such, Oster, he'd have access to a lot of officers' wives there. As such, Oster was able to build up a dense network of contacts to Western countries. He was in the thick of secret efforts to prevent a Czech invasion in 1938. So he's going against Hitler's plans in 1938, right, and trying to throw a monkey wrench into the works. Through his office, he arranged for emissaries to Great Britain to urge the British to stand firm over the Czech Sudeten crisis, clear treason. Hitler's diplomatic triumph with Chamberlain in Munich left the conspirators disheartened. Some lost interest, at least temporarily, but Oster did not give up. He took upon himself the central planning of all future plot plans. To understand the contempt that Hermann Giesler expresses for Hans Oster, the following incident should suffice. Oster informed the Netherlands military attaché, his friend Bert Sass in Berlin, more than 20 times of the exact date of the many times weather-delayed invasion of the Netherlands. Sass passed the information to the government, but was not believed. Oster himself said he calculated that his treason could cost the lives of 40,000 German soldiers, nice guy, but concluded that it was necessary to prevent even more deaths during a protracted war should Germany achieve an early victory. Oster worked closely with Hennig von Treskow, chief of Army Group Center, and with General Friedrich Albrecht, head of the German General Army Office at the Bender Block in Berlin. It was Oster's Abwehr Group that supplied the English-made bombs that Treskow used in the assassination attempts of 1943. One of this group was Hans von Dohnányi, Dietrich Bonhoeffer's part Hungarian Jewish brother-in-law. But trouble came in April 1943 when the Gestapo entered the Abwehr to arrest Dohnányi for violations of foreign exchange regulations, illegal money transfers to be exact, including cash transactions with Jauch and Hubner, Germany's largest insurance company. Today, it is American firm A. Walter Jauch. Today, its American firm, A. Walter Jauch, was related by marriage to Hans Oster. Present at the time, so the traitors escaped to America, right? At least some of them. Present at the time, Oster was caught trying to hide incriminating notes. That was the end of his Abwehr intrigues. He was dismissed and closely watched by the Gestapo from then on. Dohnányi was eventually sent to the Sachsenhausen detention camp for political prisoners, where he was put to death on April 8, 1945, as a July 20th conspirator. He was a conspirator in the Valkyrie plot. Oster was arrested on July 21, 1944, the day after the assassination. On April 4, 1945, the diaries of Wilhelm Canaris were discovered. That sealed the fate of both men.
You have to wonder, what kind of conspirator keeps a detailed diary of his own conspiratorial intrigues? He must have thought that not only would he succeed, but he could bring them out 5 or 10 years later and be famous, and the world would love him, and he'd be a legend, you know, in the annals of history.
Well, it's right. It's obvious to me that he hoped to be a legend after the British and the Soviets won the war. That's very obvious. That's the only thing that could account for his pretentiousness.
I mean, if you were plotting to assassinate somebody, and assuming you're legitimate and it's an actual patriotic effort, you're not going to write about it in a detailed diary.
Well, right, but I'm sure that wasn't Canaris's only treachery, because he had been working against Germany in the war effort the whole time he was in his office.
If I'm not mistaken, every single German spy that was sent to Britain was detained, arrested, and flipped, and they were made to send false reports back to Germany. And the Abwehr had a lot to do with that.
I'm sure. Oster was arrested on July 21st, 1944, the day after the assassination, or assassination attempt, we would call it. On April 4th, 1945, the diaries of Wilhelm Canaris were discovered. That sealed the fate of both men. Thus, on April 9th, Oster and Canaris, along with Bonhoeffer and four other men, were hanged at Flossenbürg as traitors to their country. Wilhelm Canaris had been playing a double game for a long time. Enough evidence had finally come to light that Hitler had already dismissed him from the Abwehr in February 1944, replacing him with Walter Schellenberg, and merging much of the Abwehr with the Sicherheitsdienst, or SD, the SS security office headed by Heinrich Himmler. Canaris was put under house arrest, preventing him from taking part in the July 20th plot. An interesting detail, under Canaris and Oster and Donanyi, hundreds of Jews were given token Abwehr training and issued papers to leave Germany. One of those is said to have been the Lubavitcher Rebbe in Warsaw, Rabbi Yosef Schneerson. If true, we can thank Canaris for the strong presence of the Lubavitcher tribe in the United States, in Brooklyn, where they have a different messiah every couple of years. Back to Hermann Giesler. Years later, as a war criminal at Landsberg, I would hear in our round walks in the jail yard the rather dreamy opinion held by Oster. By betraying the German operation plans, causing the deaths of countless German soldiers, no, that was by no means treason, according to Oster. Oster just wanted to avoid an extension of the war goals to the north and west. He only wanted to counteract the attack on Denmark and Norway, Belgium and Holland, all neutral states. The governments of those states had only been warned by Oster so they could protest in time before God and the world about Hitler's intention to attack. That might stop Hitler and force him to a peaceful settlement of all conflicts. These were unlikely explanations and justifications for high treason and Landsverrat. So it's very clear that Germany was betrayed right from the beginning and right from out of her own intelligence services, right?
Hitler was planning a war of aggression, though, so warning the Allies, oh, Hitler's going to attack Czechoslovakia. That wasn't going to happen, but the Soviets were building up Czechoslovakia to serve as a jumping-off point for their invasion of Central Europe. They had air bases there. They were stationing fighters and bombers and everything. They were really getting Czechoslovakia ready as a springboard.
No doubt. Another of these prophets who thought they could define treason as a cavalier offense and considered it proper to sacrifice German soldiers and endanger the nation's existence for the higher cause of humanity was the diplomat and former undersecretary at the Foreign Office, Ernst von Weizsäcker. I am sure he expressed the opinion in order to justify his own behavior. I met him at the Landsberg WCP, or war criminal camp, with open contempt. To the ones who were influenced by that prattle, I said, a peaceful settlement of all conflicts had been successfully prevented by those new propagandists because Adolf Hitler did not want war, and a war in the East was forced upon him by the East as well as by the West, as we have proven. I said to them, combined with the reasonable land reform, Adolf Hitler would have preferred to build, perform social work, and do an outstanding job of renewing cities. Many of those imbeciles really believed the Autobahn was nothing else but a road megalomania. All that mental confusion I met with a quotation which was attributed to Napoleon, but was really by Josef Görres from the Rheinische Merker newspaper in 1814, quote, "No people are more gullible than the Germans. Among them, they strangled each other and believed by doing it, they have done their duty. No other nation on this earth is dumber. No sillier lie can be dreamed. The Germans believe it. A slogan handed to them will cause persecution of their own people more severe than against their real enemies." I must say, that describes Americans today. The weeks I spent at the Führer headquarters, Wolfschanz, in August 1944 were the most turbulent ones I ever experienced in my life. What I saw troubled me deeply. I felt the downfall. I thought the Reich would now collapse. The fronts were shaking. Threat closed in from all sides. Add to that the depression of being more and more aware of the scope of the treason done. The assassination of July 20th was like a stone thrown into calm water, causing first a bubbling stir, then by the interrogations and confessions, forming circle after circle, until finally, Gordler's grandiose, mad obsession of confessing, traitor now of the traitors. But now, when in the center of the bubble still are arising and bursting, a last circle is formed before the water's viscosity holds to its own. But just that circle, for many not visible anymore, caused Adolf Hitler a big shock, the front itself. For years he asked himself, why all those failures? The enemy knew about our military operations at the same time as our commanding officers received them. Already in 1942 in Winiza, he told me something wrong is going on. He suspects treason at the highest level. After the catastrophe of Stalingrad, communist emigrants worked openly together with the part of the officers captured by the Russians. The collapse of Army Group Center from the Russian attack of July 1944 caused the loss of 25 German divisions and hit Adolf Hitler hard. He suspected treason here also, as he did at the failure of the Citadel Offensive the previous year. The investigations following the assassination revealed and then confirmed Adolf Hitler's suspicion of high treason. General Hennig von Treskow, General Staff Officer of Army Group Center, shot himself. General Staff Major Joachim Kuhn deserted to the Russians. The statement of Wilhelm Leuschner, former Hessian Secretary of the Interior and future Vice Chancellor under Gordler, clarified the situation further. Leuschner's statement didn't get much attention at first at the Wolfschanze, but he made a statement after his conviction and, faced with death, there is hardly any doubt that he spoke the truth. By that statement, the scope of the treason causing the destruction of Army Group Center became clearer. At the same time, Ludwig Beck, the former chief of the General Staff, glimmered in an enigmatic light. Knowing that the assassination failed and the revolt fell apart, he took his life already on that evening of July 20th at the Bendlerstrasse. So we see that there was treachery and treason on the Eastern Front, which we didn't really see from the sources that we used to describe that loss several weeks ago.
Operation Bagration, that's the offensive that destroyed Army Group Center, began in late June in 44, and I have to wonder if the Soviets didn't, of course, coordinate that with the Western Allies who were invading France, but also with the bomb plot saying, okay, we're starting this great offensive. In the next 2 or 3 weeks, you need to try and kill Hitler. That way it'll, you know, cut off the head of the German military, and we'll just steamroller right into Poland and crush Army Group Center. We'll cut off Army Group North, and we'll be in Berlin before the end of the year.
Well, right, but with such high-level cooperation like von Treskow and Joachim Kuhn, it's very likely that having a general and a major, at least, and we don't know who else, in their pockets, that the Russians had plenty of intelligence on the whereabouts, the positions, the strengths of Army Group Center, that they would know exactly what was going on and have a great advantage with any offensive.
They probably knew the order of battle and the force disposition.
Absolutely. Treason in the West. Another translator's commentary. Giesler says little about how Valkyrie played out on the Western Front. To fill it in, conspirator, Lieutenant Colonel Caesar von Hofficker, officer on the staff of General Karl Heinrich von Stulpnagel, military chief of France, received a call from Stauffenberg at 4 o'clock in the afternoon telling him that Hitler was dead. Based on that, this is on July 20th, of course, Stulpnagel issued the order to arrest members of the SS command post in Paris, according to the Valkyrie plan. Field Marshal Gunther von Kluge's chief of staff, General Speidel, or Speidel, and we'll be talking about him, got the call from Stupnagel's chief of staff, General Blumentritt, but decided to wait for Klug to return from the front. The arrest of around 120 members of the SS took place before two Waffen SS generals were informed and a Navy attachment was alarmed, enough to warn of armed intervention unless the SS prisoners were released. By then, radio and telephone were revealing that Hitler was alive. Klug returned to headquarters at 6 p.m. and summoned Stupnagel and General Spurl, Blumentritt, and Speidel to report to him. During the following 2 hours, they shared a tense but civil dinner until a call from General Stief at OKH gave the definite word that Hitler was alive and any action on Stauffenberg's Valkyrie is madness. After Stupnagel returned to Paris, von Klug relieved him of his command, replaced him with Blumentritt, whom he ordered to tidy up and get back to normal. But this was not possible. It became another inglorious end of suicide and suicide attempts for the conspirators. That this Speidel is an interesting character. I've mentioned him before. He has my attention because he became a four-star general. He was a German general on the German side of the war in World War II, and he became a four-star general for NATO by 1956 for NATO land forces in Europe. General Hans Speidel, Valkyrie conspirator and chief of staff of Army Group B under Erwin Rommel and then under Gunther von Klug, was in one of the most commanding spots at the Normandy invasion front. He continued to tell the OKW to hold back divisions because the landing location was not certain. The
one
Spanish
thing I want to point out, too, about the Abwehr operatives in England at the time, they kept reinforcing the idea that Normandy was a fake and the real invasion was going to come at Pas-de-Calais. And in fact, that's one of the key reasons that some of the officers went along with holding back divisions, because they were getting intelligence reports from spies who had been feeding them information at the behest of the British. And
Exactly. Most of the Abwehr spies were traitors. The Spanish super spy for Germany, Alcazar de Velasco, said after the war, quote, "It's because of him, Speidel, we lost the war." Speidel survived to become a four-star general in charge of NATO land forces in Middle Europe. That tells me everything I need to know. All the other German generals went off to the Gulag, or they sat trial in Nuremberg, and this guy, who's a German general holding back the German reinforcements and panzer divisions, which would have stopped the D-Day invasion, and he held them back, and he becomes a four-star general under NATO for the other side after the war. That's just incredible. If I could point to one German general who could be the scapegoat for Germany's defeat and the conquest of the world by Jewry, it would be General Speidel. That may not be fair, but I mean, this guy was taken care of.
And that raises the issue. Was he married to a Jewess or something?
Well, he was the one man at most crucial point in the D-Day invasion that helped it succeed, and he was a German general.
So Speidel was easily worth at least 10 Allied divisions.
Well, I would say so, yes, at least. Okay, let's get back to Hermann Giesler. To complete the score of treason and infidelity, sometime during the 15th and 18th of August, Adolf Hitler learned of a conspiracy attempt between the German military leadership in the West and the Allies. We've already seen glimmers of that, right? The breach of loyalty and suicide attempt by General Karl Heinrich von Stupnagel, military commander of France, was alarming. Field Marshal Gunther von Klug, Supreme Commander West, was relieved of his service and called back to headquarters for report. On the way to the airfield, He took poison.
I wonder
they
why.
Killed themselves. They were guilty. Of course they were guilty. If they weren't guilty, they wouldn't have killed themselves. A contradiction in itself was, on one side, the at that time known efforts of the field marshal to enter into negotiations with the Allies for an armistice without the Führer's knowledge, even though he must have known that would cause the collapse of all fronts, and on the other side, the fact that shortly before his death, he sent the Führer a letter assuring him of his loyalty. Mm. What a swell guy.
Apparently, Kluge sent him a letter just before his suicide, too, imploring him to make peace, seek a settlement with the West and the Soviets, and, quote, put an end to a hopeless struggle when necessary. Although, you know, Hitler had been trying to make peace for the last 10 years, but the international Jewry would have had none of it. I mean, that's like saying, you know, make peace with the devil. How do you do it? You can't declare a ceasefire with Satan.
Absolutely. At one of those evenings at the Wolf's Lair, or Wolfschanze, Adolf Hitler talked to me about those treasonous affairs and said, "Those were the worst days of my life. How easy and simple it would be for me to terminate my life. What is my life? Added to all those disappointments, only struggle and worry and grinding responsibility. Fate and providence assigned those tasks and burdens to me. And doesn't the last assassination just demand more steadfastness than ever to continue to struggle with trust and confidence? And if that struggle is to make sense, we must succeed in exterminating the bearers of that treason, because all the effort, all the bravery are in vain against treason within your own people." Yeah, you know, this is an important letter for us, an important example for us today, that we cannot succeed against Satan, the powers of Satan, the international Jew, the banker, the system, the however you want to term that this one world order, that these evil people that have taken over our nations, we can't succeed against them, because half of our race are on their side, and then half of the half that left would easily sell out for them for the rewards of this world. And that's a clear and a clear lesson for us today, that we just can't do it without our God. We have to turn to Yahweh, our God, first.
Well, absolutely. The beast doesn't have enough of its own people to oppress us. The beast can only oppress us because we collaborate in our own oppression and in our own subjugation. If you think about what's going on, particularly in South Africa, the South African Air Force, since the end of apartheid, has fallen into such disarray, they've only managed to train, I believe, one black pilot in the last about 18 to 20 years. So they're relying solely on white pilots to operate their fighters and their helicopter gunships and their police helicopters and all those cute little aircraft that they would use to put down an uprising of the Boer.
Well, look at the history of Germany. Up until the war started in 1939, what we had, the devastation of the First World War, Germany never lost a battle on her own soil, yet when she disarmed herself, she was taken advantage of and turned over to the whims of the French and the Jewish bankers in the city and basically enslaved at Versailles. And with the Weimar Republic and all of its decadence and corruption and the basically what happened in Germany during the Weimar Republic, what was at least as bad as what happened to America in the 1960s, right? And we rolled over and took it. But Adolf Hitler brought Germany up from the ashes. These generals had to experience that. They were young men during the Weimar Republic. They must have seen the renaissance that happened in Germany during the first seven of Hitler's years.
Wow.
And they still, well, I'm counting from 1932 to 1939, or 1933 to 1939, they must have seen the renaissance that happened to Germany and the breaking of the shackles of the international Jew, and they still didn't care for it. They still wouldn't stand for it. They still sold out to the Jews in the city like a bunch of little sissy whores. It's absolutely incredible.
You call it a renaissance, but if you're Hans Oster and you want to go with another man's wife, then the Hitler government's not a good government. You want it to be a Weimar government.
Well, absolutely. The Weimar government's a lot more compatible with your lasciviousness, right?
Absolutely. Since the Hitler government and the morality it brought in really put a damper on the lifestyle of those creeps.
Well, right. But when you look at some of these other generals that were traitors to the cause, when you look at Hans Oster, he doesn't look like a Jew at all. And Speidel and these men, a lot of these men are just perfect example. I mean, Canaris is suspect, but a lot of these other men are just perfect examples of what we would consider the ideal Aryan male. And they were a bunch of whores and sellouts to the Jews and the British. That they couldn't have had any firm foundation at all of what happened to Germany from 1914 through 1939. And it's incredible to see a nation like Germany turn itself around like it did, and to see its own people, it's the cream of its own crop, to see half of them sell out that nation. I'm saying half. It's a great percentage of Germany's generals were involved in these plots against Hitler. So if we think that we could, if Hitler, with all of his successes and all of his the unity of the German people that supported him, and he couldn't pull it off, that's why the Revelation says, "Who can fight with the beast?" Who can fight with the beast? We need our God. We can't win this without Yahweh, period. The Aryan man will never prevail when he's detached from his God. He has to follow the ways of his God and obey his laws and seek his will, and then we'll prevail. That has to come first, and that's the only way we'll prevail.
We can see the historical precedent for when we've given it the best we had, and it still didn't work. It still wasn't enough.
Absolutely. That this is a shining example.
Although one might say too that if the white Israelite people around the world actually obeyed scripture and had the British and Americans locked hands with the Germans, communism would have been dead. That would have been the end of it.
No doubt.
But
no doubt. If the Saxon men had stood up for a moral society in unison and stood up for those Ten Commandments hanging on the walls of every church, that's all we need. If you love me, keep my commandments, we would never fail. A moral people, and we need that first. And all these white nationalists and all of these pagans with their immoral, disgusting ways and their perverted attitudes, that they will never get anywhere. I don't care how many of them there are. There could be 500 million of them. There could be a zillion of them. They're going to fail if we're not a moral people.
They're no better than Hans Oster.
Well, working in concept and in concert with our God, that there's no way that we will ever succeed.
Absolutely.
Okay, let's get back to this material. I'll pick it up again with Hermann Giesler.
All right.
How malicious and wretched is that treason? I could sense it all through the years. These are Hitler's words, according to Giesler. But struggled with myself to believe that German officers, generals, could be connected with it beyond any imagination is treason during a war, treason against the nation, and treason against the fighting soldiers. They sold out their own people, their own kin. I believed I could win them over with the existence of Germany was at, when the existence of Germany was at risk, even Europe. I stood up to overcome Marxism and introduce instead a socialism of a unified nation. I did win the workmen, but I misjudged the reactionary. Here they were in the Reichswar, within industry, the powerful economic and money circles. They were here too, as failed politicians and diplomats. I misjudged their ambition, their need for admiration, and their intellectual shortcomings. All that I misjudged. I forgot to get rid of those fossils of a long past era. Let me say that early in his career, in his political career, Hitler actually respected them. In a time of urgency, reconstruction, reformation, war requirements, and burdening pressure, I forgot that I am a revolutionary. That someone from that reactionary group might at some time shoot at me, I thought about that and had to live with it. But I never believed it possible that a general staff officer was able to commit such a characterless crime, even though, due to my experience since 1938, I had to expect all that. They didn't have the courage to openly resist me or shoot me. We have to create a new aristocracy, a value and rank order based on character, courage, and steadiness. One sentence of Nietzsche's I can identify with: what today can prove if one be of value or not, that he is steadfast. The evening closed with discussions about city rebuilding and reconstruction. It was denial. Was it denial and relaxation? Was it confidence? I don't know. That night, Adolf Hitler was dealing with traffic structures of cities. Escapism. It is inference. Escapism is the inference there. Would you like to that concludes part three of the series. Would you like to
you want me to take over for part four?
Yes.
Part four, Valkyrie, the last plot against Hitler, methods and morals of the traitors. Original translation from Hermann Geisler's memoir, Ein Anderer Hitler, Drufel Verlag. I'm going to stop there, I'm just butchering that. 1982, by Carolyn Jaeger and Wilhelm Mann. Führer Headquarters, Wolfschanze, autumn 1944. Valkyrie was the codename for the alarm-ready troop response to emergency situations in the Reich. Troops in their barracks and boot camps, soldiers on leave and in training classrooms. They should prevent revolts of prisoners of war and foreign workers. Valkyrie also meant military actions against enemy landings on the coastal shores and via airborne operations. In short, all actions necessary to protect the Reich. By their nature, the armed forces were in command. The investigations of the July 20th assassination were now finished in principle. Isolated at his sleeping cell during an illness in September 1944, Hitler had time to reflect. He told me, Valkyrie was planned for the protection of the Reich. The plotters used Valkyrie as a deceiving tool for a cunning coup d'etat, but they could not turn their powerful positions and the potential they had to their advantage. In that, they had neither the ability nor the strength to make decisions. The assassination, the ignition, as they called it, failed. The conspirators did not have a Brutus. An aristocrat, a colonel, with the knowledge and approval of a general's clique, tried to take me from this world by deceit. I have to admit that the hypocrisy, cowardice, and maliciousness, the breach of oath, treason, and Landesverrat hurt me more than the explosion of the hellish machine which English explosives that the aristocrat had put under the work table. From a safe distance, he watched the explosion. The co-conspirator and general of communications, Filgebel, at his side. Then he flew back to Berlin full of energy to trigger Valkyrie. It must have been a shock for that general to see that his victim was only lightly injured, yet he was still shameless enough to congratulate him. He considered it too dangerous to warn his fellow conspirators in Berlin. Well, they were ready to command soldiers, to give them orders that could cost them their lives, but they themselves were not ready for that. They would have thought themselves too important. And we see that time and time again. All these generals from, 38 onward, they're plotting to kill Hitler. They're plotting to destroy the Reich. They're plotting this. They're plotting that. They're agreeing with other people. Oh, that's right. You should be a suicide bomber. Take Hitler out. But we don't see any of them volunteering to be the suicide bomber, do we?
Not one of them. But and very important aspect of this is that all the time they were, as Geisler suggested at the beginning of part three, is that all the time that they're spending plotting against Hitler, they're not doing their jobs in fighting the war.
Absolutely. If they would have spent half as much time conducting the war as opposed to plotting against their own government and the Reich, and for that matter, the German people at large, they might have won the war.
Absolutely.
But instead we see that they're so treacherous, they're so cowardly, they're all plotting ways that they can bomb Hitler, kill him, not be in the blast, not get any repercussions, not get gunned down by his bodyguards. They can be safely away, hundreds of miles away, and hijack his military while he's lying dead. Where if they actually had a backbone, if they weren't just jellyfish, they would have just walked up to him and shot him with a pistol and maybe turned it on themselves so his guards couldn't arrest them and interrogate them and find out who helped them.
Well, right. Just like Feldgebel had that opportunity after the bomb exploded, seeing that Hitler survived, and he didn't take it. And he had a pistol on his belt. And he spoke to Hitler, and he was one of the conspirators, and he didn't take it. They were cowards.
And I like the reference to Brutus here, since look at what Brutus did. I mean, I absolutely disagree with the assassination of Caesar because I think he was a great man. But that aside, Brutus didn't plot to poison Caesar and be outside of Rome when Caesar was having dinner and dying. He stuck the knife right into his chest.
Absolutely. And Caesar just said, "Et tu, Brute? You too, Brutus?" And Brutus could at least face the man that he was killing.
Absolutely.
It was treachery, but it wasn't cowardice.
These people, if they'd have been able to, they probably would have used some kind of cruise missile if they had them back then. Oh, let's kill Hitler with an unmanned aerial vehicle. We can be 500 miles away.
Well, that's how a Jew usually tries to do things, right?
All right. And here the article even gets into this. Not one had the courage to face him openly with a weapon. Instead of entering history by a manly deed, they tried to fell their supreme commander by treachery. Only self-sacrifice would have given them a chance to distinguish their act from that of a cowardly criminal. And I often told someone, too, you know, when I was talking about the Oklahoma City incident with a friend, I said that, one, I don't believe McVeigh did it, but that's aside the point, assuming, you know, for sake of argument, he did it. If what you're doing is important enough that hundreds of innocents are going to die in the process, then you better die, too, otherwise you're just a coward. So if it's important enough to that other people are going to die as collateral damage, then the perpetrator better sacrifice himself in the process, too, or he's just a miserable, contemptible coward. And that's what all these generals were, miserable, contemptible cowards.
Absolutely. And let me, we always see these words together, treason and Landsverrat. Well, Landsverrat is also treason. I don't know what the German word is here for treason, but Landsverrat is a special kind of treason of passing domestic or military secrets to a foreign power.
Mm. So specifically military treason.
Yes.
All right. How did they justify breaking their oath? Who would give them the right to assassination and revolt at a time of highest pressure and distress, at a time when fierce battles were fought on all fronts? They tried to justify their deed by pretending they were acting in the interest of higher human goals. They saw Churchill, Roosevelt, and even Stalin as their guarantors. They said that for the sake of humanity's higher objectives, the blood sacrifice of German soldiers and their comrades is justified. I suppose they figured that the communists hadn't killed enough Germans yet, they should help them kill some more. Since we all know that Stalin is the greatest peacemaker in the history of the world, right? He was just defending the Soviet Union when he invaded Poland.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's one thing to say we should make peace with the Western allies, the Anglo-Americans, but how can you make peace with Genghis Khan, who's riding in from the steppes?
Well, that's called spin, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, Russia was on our side. They were on the side of the Jews, right? They were Jews. The Bolsheviks were Jews. Stalin was just a Bolshevik. He was a Jew. And the entire Russian leadership under him were Jews. If they weren't Jews, they were married to Jews. They were whores to the Jews.
A few years ago, reading a history textbook, I saw a picture of a propaganda poster from World War II, and it had a picture of a Russian soldier with the big fur hat on, and it was from, I think, 1943, and it said, "This man is a Russian. He is your friend and ally. He is fighting for freedom and democracy. Help him kill the Germans."
Well, right, and that's city propaganda. That's London propaganda. That's the propaganda of the London Jewish bankers. The World War II was basically the Western capitalist Jews against it, and their little brothers, the Eastern Marxist Jews, and the destruction of Christian Germany, and the American and British people believed the propaganda of the Western capitalist Jews and signed on to go get those evil Nazis who were actually our Christian brethren.
Absolutely. I remember the propaganda film, Why We Fight. I watched it when I was young, and I didn't think much of it. And I watched it again a while ago, just about a few months ago. And at one point, they talk about how Germany hated freedom of religion, and the only religion acceptable was the worship of Hitler, where Americans were, you know, fighting to save Christian civilization. They even played the song Onward, Christian Soldiers. And yet today, Bush makes a passing reference to a crusade against terrorism, and there's an uproar and a hellstorm over it because he said crusade, and it offended a Muslim. So, you know, and they want to tell us that we fought for religious freedom.
Well, that's called spin. And the Jews spin the Russian role in World War One and World War Two, and they spin that they spin our partnership with Stalin, the mass murderer, and they spin everything. That they tell the story that everything that we think we know about history has been told through the lens of some Jew who's politicized it and politically corrected it for the Jewish world order.
Absolutely, and I just wanted to say that if Spadell were alive today, he'd probably be working for Fox News as a spin doctor, or he'd be writing books on spin doctoring, and Falgiebel would probably be with MSNBC.
Well, look at where Leon Trotsky's granddaughter's working. She's the head of the drug enforcement, of the Drug Council for the United States. She has some, I forget the exact office, I'm sorry, but she has a high position in drug enforcement in the United States.
Is that Nora Volkow?
Yes, Nora Volkow.
The National Institute on Drug Abuse.
That's it. She's the head of the National Institute on Drug Abuse. And here's the best part, all right? She's not an Obama appointee. You would expect Obama to appoint a communist leader's granddaughter to a high post in American politics, right? She's a Bush appointee. She was appointed in 2003.
Well, you know what? She's probably qualified because since her people put out almost all the drugs, she probably knows a lot about drug abuse.
It's absolutely incredible. We could have Leon Trotsky's granddaughter, and she's the daughter of her father, what was an ardent promoter of Leon Trotsky all his life, her father. And she had to be affected by that. And she's Leon Trotsky's, one of the greatest mass murderers in history, and his granddaughter is an American bureaucrat now. And a Republican appointee. That's just incredible. That, you know, these people think that these Republicans think that these people that head this Republican Party are conservatives. They're not conservatives. They're Jews with money. That's all they are. They're neocons. The neocons are Jews with money. They want to keep it. That they
want
to conserve
more. And they want more of your money. They want to conserve their money and spend yours. And I have to wonder if Alessandra Mussolini's granddaughter came over here, would she get an appointment like that? Or would they turn her back at the airport?
I don't think that if Adolf Hitler had a son, he wouldn't step foot on American soil, I'm sure. But they'd probably have him at Nuremberg. Oh, but I was only 3 years old in 1941. That's okay. You're guilty. You're going away. To the gallows.
All right. After the assassination, Adolf Hitler insisted on being fully informed and without glossing of all the results of the interrogations, the statements and testimony of the conspirators. He asked for exact information of the circle of persons involved and their reasoning. He was also interested in the operational plan for the revolt after Valkyrie. He soon found there was nothing planned, and I've often said Jews planned to destroy the existing order and replace it with nothing. They have no plans for the future. All they can do is destroy. They're destroyers and they'll remain destroyers. They've even admitted it. So they have no plans for the future. Their plan was simply to destroy the Reich and leave it prostrate before the Soviet Union. Wouldn't you agree?
I would have to agree. I mean, there's no doubt they never have a plan. Look at the revolutions in France in 1848. Even when they were successful in taking over the French government, they failed because they had no plan. They just wanted to destroy the old order. They wanted to destroy the feudal order of France. They wanted to destroy the bourgeois, who were actually the people working to run the civilization and to have a viable economy. They just wanted to destroy them, that's all, because they were white and they were Christian.
Well, Mussolini once remarked that every anarchist is just a baffled dictator. He basically said that anarchists raise their fist in righteous indignation against the established order, but once they overthrow it, they have nothing to do. There's nothing they can do. They have no ideas.
Right, and that's the lesson that we learned in the 1871, 1848, and the original French Revolutions.
Absolutely. The first proclamations of the bearers of an illusory power were lies. With lies, they confronted the nation and the armed forces. After what they thought was a successful assassination, they didn't have the courage to confess to it. So you would think that perhaps they might have been like Brutus, Cassius, and Casca and the others running through the streets with their bloody daggers shouting, "The tyrant is dead, we've done it, we've done it, we've done it." Instead, they're just claiming, "Oy vey, Hitler is dead, we will run things from now on. We don't know who killed him." Mr. Falgiebel could not turn off all telephone lines. I was able to talk to Dr. Goebbels and the major of the Berlin Guard Battalion Grosse Deutschland, and that was, I believe, Otto Ernst Rehmer. Am I correct, sir? Does that name ring a bell with you?
I'm sorry, repeat that name?
Otto Ernst Rehmer. He was the major in charge of the Berlin Guard Battalion Grosse Deutschland, Greater Germany.
Yes, I'm not sure if he's been mentioned in this yet.
All right. Who then cleared up the confusion. The putsch collapsed. The conspirators had not one company on their side. Apparently, from what I heard, and this was from a History Channel documentary, so, I mean, take it for what it's worth, they claim that Goebbels was able to put through Rehmer directly to Hitler at the Wolfschanze.
Right, that's right. He was actually the gentleman who, he played the hero at the failed putsch, and he had arrested the conspirators in the Bendlers block.
Absolutely. And
yes, he spoke to Hitler directly, and because the putsch failed because of him and his quick thinking and his ability, because Falgiebel failed to seal up all of the communications line, he failed to shut them all down. That putsch failed because of that, because he was able to speak to Hitler. And that was portrayed last week in part two of this, and you weren't here, you missed it.
And after the war, Rehmer founded a new National Socialist Party, which was later dismantled and banned by the German government in West Germany. He actively denied the Holocaust. Then he was indicted. He spent about several years in prison in Germany, and then he fled to Spain, where he eventually died. And one of his fellow colleagues, a veteran from the Gross Deutschland Division, said this about him, and take it for what it's worth, because this quote is coming off a wiki, but it is sourced. It came out of the Secret Germany, published in London by the Penguin Group, and he writes, "We, his former comrades, have deeply regretted that destiny confronted this young officer in July 1944 with a situation with consequences the bearing of which I should assume are beyond the powers of any human being. No judgment will be made here as to whether his decisions on 20 July were right or wrong, but the consequences of his decisions were so terrible and have cost so much of the best German blood that we old soldiers had expected that a man to whom destiny gave such a burden to carry until the end of his life would recognize this and would thereafter live quietly and in seclusion. We, his former comrades, lack any sympathy for the fact that Herr Rehmer fails to summon up this attitude of self-effacement." Well, they are passing judgment against him. They're saying they don't like that he's still a National Socialist and denies the Holocaust.
Well, right. And Rehmer was actually, he must have been highly faithful to Hitler. He knew something was wrong. He got in touch with Hitler at the Wolfschanze, and Hitler gave him the order to snuff out the plot against him with all his might and energy, as Giesler describes it, and made Rehmer the de facto commandant of Berlin until the newly appointed commander of the home army arrived, Himmler, and Rehmer did his, he followed the order. He followed the order without question. He was absolutely faithful.
From what I've read, he was ordered by a general, a traitor, to go arrest Goebbels at the propaganda ministry.
Yes, he was.
He went there to go arrest Goebbels, and Goebbels basically said, "Think about what you're doing. Why would Hitler order you to arrest me? I guarantee you he's still alive. We'll get him on the phone for you right now. And he recognized Hitler's voice, of course, and Hitler said, they're trying to destroy Germany. You need to put a stop to this. Mobilize your battalion. And he did.
Well, right, but the way Giesler described it, I think that Giesler, if I remember from last week, Giesler, all right, I'll read it here. By 6 p.m., the platoons were all in their position places. Raymer checked them out and returned to Hess's headquarters at Unter den Linden when he overheard a muffled talk between Hess and his chief of staff, Lieutenant Colonel Schoen, to arrest Goebbels. He knew there was something fishy going on. He called his officers to a meeting. In other words, the way Giesler portrays it is that Raymer discovered a plot amongst these officers in the Bendler's block, and then he summoned his officers to a meeting and decided what to do about it.
All right.
He goes on to say, Joseph Goebbels was Gauleiter for Berlin and Minister for Propaganda and Cultural Affairs, but also Reich's Defense Commissioner for the GAU Berlin. Lieutenant Hagen, one of Major Raymer's officers who worked for a time at Goebbels' ministry, suggested he visit Goebbels at his residence immediately. This is when Raymer found out there was a plot and called his officers together, right? Raymer was suspicious that perhaps Goebbels was involved in a party conspiracy against Hitler, and Goebbels was not sure about Raymer. After a dramatic verbal exchange between the two at Goebbels' apartment, Raymer was handed the telephone and heard the Führer at the other end. But Raymer suspected something about Hess when he overheard a conversation. So he didn't know who to trust. But he wasn't trusting the people that sent him to Goebbels' house either.
All right. Mr. Feldgiebel could not turn off all telephone lines. I was able to talk to Dr. Goebbels and the major of the Berlin Guard Battalion Grosse Deutschland, who then cleared up the confusion. The putsch collapsed. The conspirators had not one company on their side. Who would give them the authority for the assassination and the coup? With one voice, the front expressed its anger. The frontline soldier could not understand how officers were able to do such a deed. The front could see the consequences and results. Its judgment was also quite clear. It would burden us. Only the enemy would benefit. I have to wonder how many lieutenants, sergeants, frontline, you know, junior officers, non-coms, you know, privates, corporals, how many of the grunts that were in the trenches that were home on leave said, hey, I'll blow up Hitler. I'll take part in this. It was all a bunch of elitist, basically, you know, pompous officers who probably the closest they'd gotten to the Russian front had been the middle of the Ukraine at some command post. They were all pencil pushers.
Well, right. They were all pencil pushers. There's no doubt that they were the elite, moneyed class of the German officers.
The reaction of a troubled community was the unanimous rejection of the assassination and coup. Worry and mistrust arose. Neither the nation nor the armed forces gave the conspirators the authority for the assassination or the coup d'etat, above all, not for rebellion and contemptible treason. From the investigation and testimony, one could learn that the conspirators did not think very far ahead. An egocentric attitude led to a euphoric opinion of the political situation, as in, first we get rid of the dictator, then via Valkyrie his party, then the Allies will help us. And once again, those vague phrases of higher human ideals for which one had to sacrifice. That's what their conscience demanded. So here they are thinking the Western Allies are going to help them against the Soviets. Well, we can see what the Western Allies want to do in regards to help. They want to send more and more supplies to the Soviets so the Soviets can crush and kill and subjugate the Germans. With friends like the Western Allies, you wouldn't need the Soviets.
Absolutely.
Also, his writings gave them a legitimate reason for their deeds. Better than many of his party comrades who were reading Mein Kampf, they rummaged through the book and found sentences they thought could translate to fit their shabby thinking. Since he drags the nation into destruction, he justifies in Mein Kampf their right to stop him through resistance, rebellion, and the coup d'etat. It is therefore not only their right, but their obligation to get rid of him, the tyrant. That's how they read Mein Kampf. He is ready to face the people's criticism at any time. Not He dragged the nation into distress, but the openly declared will of Churchill, Roosevelt, and their big ally, the international Jews, to destroy us. The reactionaries and the plotters' clique encouraged that intention, and theirs was the best way to push the nation, via the putsch and assassination, beyond the present trouble, into the abyss. No, he denies those men the right of high treason, rebellion, and the right to assassinate. Where, indeed, could they ever have shown the power to build a new state regime made necessary by the last war in the new century? Again and again he asks himself, where really are their ideas? What can they offer the nation? And I would say only ruin and misery.
Absolutely, and it's obvious, and what Geisler is saying here is that these generals did not understand the fight that Germany was trying to fight.
Or they understood it and they wanted to sabotage it.
Well, yes, that's a possibility with some of them, I'm sure.
Only their names and an honor only they believed in. Both are tattered by their deeds. One can lift a revolution to a big wave, releasing enthusiasm, national strength, and willingness to sacrifice. One cannot keep that wave permanently. One cannot conserve it. But the start of a revolution also depends on the person who carries it and his authority, on the thoughts and ideas. If they are understood, if they have roots and find confirmation in the spirit of the time and the sense of the nation, his way to the leadership of the nation is proof of his harmony with the national spirit. The bearers of the assassination imagined a past they themselves did not understand. For him, it had been inconceivable up to now that a German officer, above all a general, could commit treason. Treason at wartime, damaging the German people, burdening the fighting German soldier. Impossible. The day will come when he can announce clearly and without misunderstanding just who instigated the war. Who? As long as the fighting goes on, he cannot talk. That shock will be too much for the German people and the front. For a commander, the most important quality is his character, his attitude. Intelligence does not stand higher. The character and the strength of his will alone are decisive when he has to withstand severe blows of fate. Courage, bravery, and willingness to sacrifice are the prerequisites of a leader. He always requests that from his soldiers. So he shall and must be a role model. Even more, he must be able to give strength and convince. So how can these people, these conspirators, these cowards, claim to have moral courage and the moral authority to lead Germany? How do they claim to have any ability to gain the loyalty and the trust of the fighting man who sacrifices every day in the trenches on the Eastern Front when they won't sacrifice even the possibility of getting injured by remaining on the scene to make sure the deed is done? They want to be miles away when the bombs go off.
Well, absolutely, that they were all cowards, that they weren't even willing to stand up for what they believed in and execute it.
When he had to accept the capitulation of Field Marshal Friedrich von Paulus and the behavior of his generals, Hitler had said, "Now they will take their way down into the lowlands of wretchedness, the oath being only a fiction. A steady character is not their strength, intellectual self-esteem more so. They may try the work with the Russians and will lose face at the same time. It won't take long, and we are going to hear them on the Russian propaganda radio. Step by step, they will show a lack of character and, in the end, slander their military tradition. They may forget they carry a name of dutiful obligation." And von Paulus was asked shortly after the war, how were the soldiers that had been captured at Stalingrad, how were they doing? And he knew that about 80% of them were already dead. And in some instances, he remarked that he would have to check into that and get back to the people that were asking. And in other instances, he said that they seemed to be doing fine. And that is horrible treason, isn't it, for him to say that when he knew otherwise?
Well, absolutely.
As the field marshal, he's ultimately responsible for every single one of his men, and he should have been doing everything he could to get them home.
That's what sellouts do. He already sold out to fill his own belly, to make sure his own life was comfortable.
There were some co-workers here, generals too, who could not believe that something like that was possible. Hitler had said, "Yes, it is, sooner or later, and all the way up a field marshal." That he still promoted Paulus to that rank, he never would forgive himself. So one leads an army. The army fights and dies, and he who was entrusted to lead that army and the soldiers Does he die heroically with his soldiers? The meaning of that battle, the heroism and sacrifice of many tens of thousands of brave soldiers, officers, and generals will lose its value, will be trampled down by the one who should have been their example. He will take the road to Moscow. We will live to see him at the radio station. And I'm reminded of the Battle of Cannae in 218 BC. I'm sorry, I'm 216 BC. And I want to point out here that there were two Roman consuls, Varro and Paulus. And Paulus urged caution, and he wanted to delay and not engage the Romans right away. And Varro said, "No, no, no, let's engage them right away. I'm sorry, engage the Carthaginians."
You mean not engage the? Yeah, right.
Yeah, he wanted the Romans were at war with the Carthaginians, and he wanted to engage the Carthaginians right away. And ultimately, Paulus, who didn't want to engage, he fought to the death on the field, while Varro, who ordered the engagement, he fled. When the battle turned against them, he just took his horse and fled.
Well, here in Stalingrad, we had a Paulus that acted like a Varro.
Hmm. Isn't that kind of shameful?
Well, it's absolutely shameful. The captain goes down with the ship, the good captain.
Although in some instances, the captain wants to be the first man off the ship.
If all of your men are dead on the field of battle and you're standing there, you've done something wrong. You haven't done the role of a good leader. You should have been out there in front.
Would you like to finish things up?
Hitler said that, and he had it right, but that it would lead to such a disgusting mess as the so-called National Committee for Free Germany by that Seydlitz Kurzbach, I myself could never have imagined. Well, Seydlitz might feel like York at Torrigan. Seydlitz and his creatures did not grasp that it was the Bolsheviks they signed up with. They didn't get it because their thinking was still entrenched in the 19th century. They hadn't learned anything at all. They hadn't recognized that this was a war of life or death, not restricted to soldiers, folk, or the nation. They could not imagine that we were involved in a fateful struggle, in a revolutionary fight for the existence of Europe, in a battle for the new idea of life, Lebensbasis, against destruction and the powers who want to destroy us, the international Jew. If we still had such schizophrenic twits who thought, what do we do? What we do that with the Russians? We drop our weapons honorably. We hand over our epi or sword, which Marshal Stalin honorably hands back to us again. Yes, in such a world, they still lived. In other words, in a world filled with medieval chivalry and the honorable acts of men. Then we sign a peace agreement with them. That's how those idiots thought, and the ones oriented towards the West thought similarly. In other words, Giesler, of course, and Hitler knew that this was a fight to the death, that there was no conditional surrender. It wasn't possible to have a peaceful surrender. Is it surprising that optimism dwindles, that our allies and the neutrals might lose their confidence? And are we surprised about the demand for unconditional surrender? What shall the front think, the soldier, when asked by those shameful tracts of cowardice to surrender, to sabotage, to commit treason, and to refuse to obey orders? Pamphlets signed by former commandants. We have to overcome that moral crisis. They wanted to end the war and submit the nation to unconditional surrender. They would have surrendered the soldiers of the Eastern Front to the Russians. They did not care. He would have been relieved of worry, sorrows, pressing responsibility, and sleepless nights if the infamy of Stauffenberg had succeeded. But what would have been the consequence? Chaos and destruction at the fronts, hate and civil war and despair. They wouldn't have understood it is not about him but Germany. Churchill declared it frankly and cynically. It is about Germany's destruction. Where can you find this in the political foundation for a conspiracy that makes history? From a rare kind, they found each other, reactionaries, liberals, Marxists, representatives of the church. the Bekenbekirk specifically, they even prayed for Germany to lose the war. And let's not forget the diplomats and the Herren generals. He cannot expect to be understood by his generals, but he can request that they obey his orders. They just could not see that we lived in a changing era and had to endure a fateful war. Instead of fighting for the nation as their oath required, they committed destruction, sabotage, and subversion. The conspirators had no right, however, for the coup destroyed any trust by the mere try. From the first war year on, I suspected treason. Often I felt it physically. I am sure the treason started much earlier. Now, after the assassination, proof of the permanent treason is clear. Still, not all traitors are recognized. What damage they caused. And that's the end of this four-part series, The Valkyrie Plot, from the memoirs of Hermann Giesler by Carolyn Jaeger and Wilhelm Mann. Thank you.
And interestingly enough, of course, these people are portrayed as heroes today since they stood up against the great Satan, Hitler.
Well, absolutely, when in fact the great Satan is really the international Jew who controlled both the East, because Bolshevism was a product of the Jewish bankers of the city and Wall Street, and they controlled the West, because America and Britain and the American and British peoples were whores for the Jews of the city and Wall Street.
They could find a diary in an attic of one of these traitors and find out he was a pedophile, and oh, he's still a hero because he rose up against Hitler.
No doubt.
All right, then, so we'll pick up next week then with the next installment.
Praise Yahweh.
Praise Yahweh. Thank you.